Hello, my name is Nyla McBain. I am the founder and editor of the Mormon Women Project, and I'm delighted to have with me today Anna Laura Solomon for a special podcast of the Mormon Women Project. Anna Laura, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Would you please introduce us to your personal situation as the daughter of lesbian parents, which of course is of particular interest to us this week with the new policy that was added to Handbook 1 and to which there has been much discussion and response over the past several days. So we're particularly excited to have you with us today and are interested in learning about how you were raised and how you found the church and how that process worked for your life in your life individually.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm 30, so to gloss over 30 years of experience in both sort of cultures is not an easy thing to do, I guess. But my parents were together for several years and then decided that they wanted to have kids. And, you know, they got flack from both sides, even inside of the gay community. I think a lot of homophobia still existed within the community itself. 30 years ago, it was pretty unclear whether or not gay people would mess kids up. And so some people were thinking, what if we do?
And by the community there, you're talking about the gay community. So your parents weren't Mormon. We're not talking about the Mormon community.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So, let's see. So they were sort of building the, particularly, I guess I would say, the lesbian community in Southwest Michigan. It definitely didn't have as large of a structure or as solid of a foundation as we're used to sort of talking about the gay community in general now. A lot of things were still pretty underground. And anyway, they decided that they did want to bring children into the world. And one of my mom's particularly talked about how she felt like it was one of the greatest and first gifts she could give me to bring me into a home where my opinions would always matter, where my ideas would always be heard, where my achievements would not be overshadowed. And that spoke to some of her experience in various family experiences for her. And so I was raised in, like, I guess because I think we're assuming we're talking to a largely Mormon audience, it was sort of like a really big lesbian relief society, and they were like very well connected. One of the stories that I tell on a regular basis is when I went to ride my bike to a friend's house, and helmets, I think, throughout time have been seen as uncool, and so I did not want to wear a helmet, and I came home, and there was my mom sitting at the table, you know, saying, Anna Laura, where's your helmet? And I thought, Mom, it's in the garage with my bike, and I was wearing it a minute ago. And she's like, that's not what Maria said. And, of course, one of my mom's friends had seen me writing and called my mom right away. And so a really close-knit group of people just trying to help each other build.
And to be clear, I just want to clarify that you are the biological daughter of one of your mothers, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so they tried to get pregnant for probably about 5 years, each sort of taking turns. And eventually, Diana, who is my biological mom, got pregnant with me. And I was the only child until I was about 10, and I have two younger sisters who are both adopted from China. They're 10 and 11 years younger than me. My biological mom was a nutritionist and a supervisor for the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children, in Southwest Michigan, and retired early. And then River was a bookstore owner for 18 years and then has done tireless work in Southwest Michigan to help the gay and lesbian community find its footing there too. So that's sort of a life work and an occupation as well, back and forth for her.
Interesting.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you about how you eventually found the church, but I mean, if you would like to tell us more stories about this wonderful Relief Society, I'd love to hear that too.
I was actually headed that direction too, and there are a couple of stories of these wonderful women I grew up with that continues through that process. I was about 17 when I had a friend in high school that was my senior year in high school, and he was in basically every single one of my classes, and so I couldn't probably have ignored him even if I tried. And did a mock mission week for his seminary class. So he was doing early morning seminary. And they all dressed up as missionaries and followed mission rules while they were going to school. He was the only one who was in our school. There were probably only 10 people in this early morning seminary class, and he was the only one who was going to my school. So he's the only one who was visible, but he was visible all day long for me. And we ended up asking each other lots of questions, and he lived a block and a half from my parents' house and needed rides everywhere. So I basically learned about the gospel in the front seat of my car, taking him anywhere he needed to go. He invited me to go to early morning seminary with him, and despite the early hour, I agreed to go when he said he needed a ride, which I found out was not true later. So he just knows how to. Anyway, he invited me to class, and I went to this early morning seminary class with him. And up until this point, they had been very casual conversations about the church. I grew up sort of in a pagan, Wiccan, universal, or Unitarian Universalist sort of religious background. And so I didn't have a lot of scriptural reading sort of experience or even terms like prophets and the lineage there and whose prophet when and things like that were all sort of basically starting from ground zero in that way. And they were all interesting conversations for me. Obviously, having two moms meant that I was instantly opposed to the church's stance on homosexuality and a number of other things, mostly sort of social justice or general practice things and not doctrine or theology-based concerns for me. And one of them was really the idea of what a Mormon woman would look like. And I had a picture in my head that was pretty narrow and had a limited scope of influence, and there were things that she could and could not do, and education wasn't one of them really. And I guess if you asked anybody what they thought a Mormon woman looked like on the streets of somewhere where there weren't lots of Mormons, I probably would have fit in pretty well there. At least 12 years ago, I would have. And the seminary teacher in the basement of her house was a well-educated, socially conscious, an active woman in her community who was an exceptional teacher, still one of the best teachers I've ever had. And her husband got up early in the morning and made bread for us while we were there too. And
Oh
so
my goodness.
the challenge to my preconceived notions of the gender roles in action was right in front of my face every morning for 45 minutes at least. And that's when things started to change, and I had her as a person to talk with about things on a level that I felt like maybe my friend wouldn't understand or lots of other people wouldn't understand. And she became a very close confidant very quickly. And I lucked out really and have had several very strong female influences in my regular Relief Society now, and not, transferring from one Relief Society to another.
And let me ask you, I mean, I think it's interesting. You said you were 17 at the time, which of course is very close to the new 18-year-old age. Do you think that your friend, the seminary student or the seminary teacher, would have been less forthcoming or less encouraging or less open with you if today's policy were in place 12 years ago? Or do you think that that experience would have been similar?
I think that it probably would be very similar. There are a number of things that are seen as controversial now that were seen as controversial 12 years ago and earlier on than that. And the history of the church is a very nuanced and complicated thing. And it was when I joined the church too. And so women's role in the church and racial issues in the church and all kinds of things were still things we were talking about then that I was very concerned about. And they were still very forthcoming and interested in having those conversations with me. So, and this, the new age limit being 18, I think I might have been just turning 17 when these conversations started happening. And it was actually my parents who asked me to wait until I was 18. And I thought that was a reasonable request. And out of respect
to
them,
why did they do that?
Waited till I was 18 anyway. Well, they were upset for different reasons and wanted to, I think, be sure that I wasn't sort of just caught up in a new thing or that I would start turning against them in conversation, which actually kind of already did. I was not like the nicest kid, and I picked fights with them on kind of a regular basis anyway, on all kinds of things, like I don't want to do the dishes, and, you know, I was a teenager, mm-hmm. so that happens to everybody. But, yeah, they just
and
wanted
they
to be sure this was my own decision. And they, I think, wanted a chance to be the parents they still wanted to be. Hmm. So that gave
were
them
they particularly concerned about the church's position on gays at that time? Just, I mean, was it the Mormon church specifically or any church's stance on homosexuality at that time?
It was probably any church's stance on homosexuality at that time. I had been to a few Christian churches who were openly accepting of gay members and had been in their youth groups and things like that. And that didn't seem to bother my parents too much. They're not huge fans of Christianity in general. And so they'd always kind of raise an eyebrow at some of that. But that was the homosexuality stance in churches was definitely something they were looking carefully at when I was going to different places.
And for you, how did you reconcile this newfound faith and the institution that, you know, was housing that this doctrine and this faith that you were interested in with your upbringing, and which was clearly full of love and you know, very happy experiences. So how did you reconcile those two things at that age?
You know, I think it's something that you have to give yourself flexibility with. That's a tradition in my family in general, is flexibility. And so definitely at first I was really upset. I used to have a really big swearing problem and let fly several times in the car in front of my friend, really frustrated. And sometimes
about the church's stance on homosexuality,
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of that emotion came from a place of feeling like it was unfair. I spent a lot of time feeling like, you know, if only President Hinckley, who I love very, very dearly, if only President Hinckley knew a few more gay people like I did, mm-hmm. you know, then maybe he mm-hmm. would not feel the way he did about homosexuality, because I know so many wonderful people and because they gave me so many gifts as a young child and brought me up in such a safe place. And as I grew in my membership in the church and also grew independently, there are other issues that came to mind too. I think having a pattern of equal visibility in the home for both men and women is an eternal principle in the church too, that there's a mother there complicates a lot of things. And I've sort of hung my hat on that a few different times too. But this weekend was hard for everybody. And even if it's not an issue that's hard for me in the same way as it is for other people, those baptismal covenants that I made when I was 18 and that I read about as I was preparing to be baptized include those moments of just mourning with people who are mourning. And so sometimes it was just enough to let yourself feel things that were hard too. Yeah. So I wouldn't say I ever landed on one sort of thing to say, oh, well, this explains away all of it. It comes and it goes. And I think it does for everybody, and I think that should be okay.
Well, tell me about your process of joining the church then. You know, it's clear that these people that were influential in your conversion knew where you were coming from. How did your family situation impact the process of meeting with ecclesiastical leaders at that time?
Sure.
Was there, you know, did they ask you to, in the new language, disavow your parents' marital situation?
Yeah, you know, I would be surprised if even after the policy is added to the handbook, if any ecclesiastical leaders will actually use the word disavow. It feels like a really unusual. I just feel like it's not a thing. It's not a vocabulary word that easily finds itself in the middle of conversation. Nobody knew really what to do with me, I think, at first. Mm. And there wasn't a policy in the handbook about something like this. There wasn't a program or like a box to check or anything that fast-tracked any part of the process. And so there was some waiting for me, even if I had gotten the green light from my parents. The fact that I didn't just made those waiting times sort of overlap. But the missionaries that I met with talked to their mission presidents, and I had a baptismal interview from district leaders who were over the missionaries I'd been meeting with, and a few conversations with the mission president. It's actually also something that comes up in every temple recommend interview that I've ever had, and I'm the one to bring it up. Anytime people ask about family or organizations mm-hmm. that I support, it's always something I say, you know what, let's have a conversation about this, and have always been met with kindness and
really?
Have had really exceptional conversations. Yeah, disavowed your parents' marital situation sort of conversation, it wasn't necessarily about making sure that I was prepared to separate myself in every way from my parents, who were obviously doing horrible things. Instead, it became a really interesting space for my voice to be heard. I was able to ask questions, and I was able to sort of voice some of my perspective and get feedback from these people who I considered to be of pretty high standing and who have thought about the gospel longer than I had. And so it was a great opportunity to sort of meld our two experiences. And it's reasonable, I think, to be sure that I understood the church's stance on it and was okay with aligning myself and accepting and living by the teachings of the church. And that means that a conversation about my parents would be negligible to have not had.
Do you think without a policy in place that others would have had similarly positive experiences, or do you think that there have been instances where maybe ecclesiastical leaders have abused that relationship between an interested child, a child who wants to be baptized in the church, and his or her parents? What's your feeling about the consistency of that positive experience up until now? Do you think there have been times that it's been abused instead of been this really positive thing like it was for you?
Yeah. I definitely count my blessings that it's been a positive experience for me. I can't say that I have run into too many other people who've needed to have that same kind of conversation, but on sort of a broader look at the way policies are handled in the church, I think once it's written down on paper, any number of experiences can happen. And I do know that there have been times where people have walked away feeling like they've had bad experiences, maybe not with this particular policy since it's so new, and since I don't know lots of other kids with gay parents who wanted to join the Mormon church. But enacting policy is always a difficult thing. And where is the line between personal interpretation and exercising the mantle of the calling that you hold? A lot of my sister in particular has responded to this idea of mandatory disciplinary council stuff, and that sounds really bad. And I have some friends who have had experiences where bishops have shown up at their houses, or bishops have cornered them at the end of an activity and just said, please don't bring your partner back with you to another activity. If you do, I'll have to ask you to leave. And that's not in line with any policy that we have or had then when it happened. And none of this policy speaks to outcomes exactly. And I have had enough.
What do you mean by that?
Well, a disciplinary council really just means people meeting in a room together, and how those priesthood leaders decide to handle after they've had a conversation with a person varies to enormous degrees. The apostasy part, I think I'm speaking less to that as the things that I think it said something like disciplinary counsel may be necessary if, and has a large sort of paragraph including all kinds of things. But I think we're stepping away from the possibility of one individual person speaking out of turn when we have a formal setting with more than one person involved. And that means we have more than one person's experiences informing that conversation. And I think...
So you think you see that as a positive?
Yeah, I really do. I really, really do. And I wouldn't try to convince somebody who disagreed with me of that because they think they're entitled to their own opinions about it. But, I mean, the more people we have in a conversation, the more level-headed it's bound to be. And the more formal it is, the easier it is to sort of follow a train if something goes wrong, to be able to get in touch with someone else if you have something formal in place. So... anyway.
Are you glad that you were 18 when you joined the church?
Yeah. Yeah, I really am. And I don't know if there's a huge difference in terms of like cerebral ability to have different conversations between 17 and 18. But for me, it gave... If you're going to say between 8 years old and 18, that kind of comparison, I would just say there's been a lot of conversation about what that time does for a child. And if I could tell a little bit of a story which sort of illustrates that for me earlier on, I went to private school from kindergarten through eighth grade, and it was sort of like a progressive hippie school, and I always thought it was really to put me in a place that would be most conducive to a positive and safe environment for my family, that I wouldn't be bullied or I'd be less likely to be bullied or whatever, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And later on in life, I was having conversations with my parents about all kinds of things, and this came up, and my mom actually told me that being in that school was much less about me and a great deal more about her and River, and that they were able to openly parent the way that they wanted to. So they participated in fundraisers and PTA meetings and things like that that they wouldn't have openly been able to do in a regular public school when I was that age. And I think there are all kinds of kids who are at different ages who reach some sort of maturity where conversations that are typically hard might be totally feasible. But that I was 18 or that I was 17 when I started looking into the church meant that I had a whole childhood with my parents being in the driver's seat about how they wanted to parent and the way that they wanted to educate their children. And that turns out to be a thing that I'm really, really grateful for. And I mean, if you could use any standard by which you would measure exceptional parenting, and my parents would be on the top of the list there. So I'm glad that they had that time to do what they felt like they needed to do. And I guess it was a Joseph Smith quote that I heard first from President Hinckley during General Conference, which is to say, bring all that you have that is good and let us add to it. And the more time I had with my parents, the more good I had to bring with me, and have had a really enriching experience bringing pieces of that Relief Society experience to my membership in the church. It's a unique perspective, to be sure, but it wasn't too hard to translate it into something really, really beautiful.
Okay, let's talk for a minute about your parents' reaction when you did join the church, and
sure.
How did that change your relationship with them? If so, how? And were there any moments of softness and harmony over your decision to join the church?
Yeah, so I'll jump around maybe a little bit. When I first joined the church, which was about a little over 12 years ago, both of my parents had sort of different reactions. Neither of them were very positive. Diana, who's my biological mom, she was tapped in pretty emotionally. She was worried about me being barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen all the time, or living in a cave, or being dragged around by my hair, things that she really knew were not probably going to happen. But there, I think, she was experiencing just a sense of loss in that way, and worried about a new community, a new culture that she mm-hmm. didn't know anything about and probably didn't feel too welcome in. So she was feeling that. And River, because I was the kind of child that I was, kind of just brushed it off at first and just thought, you know, this is probably just a phase. You know, she mm-hmm. said, you know, she liked Xena Warrior Princess for a while. She grew out of that a little bit. So this will probably pass. And she was just willing to kind of wait it out, you know.
Yeah.
And 6 years later, when I met my husband, a lot of things sort of came up again, where they were concerned about if we had kids, would our kids be allowed to see them, things that were very emotionally charged. I don't think that there's any part of my experience with them in those 6 years that would have made them think I would keep any of my kids from them. But they were hypersensitive to all of the possibilities. And so we had very open conversations about that. And by that time, too, sort of the tables had turned a little bit for them. Diana, who I probably was a little closer with and felt like I could speak more freely with, we had had lots of conversations about the church and things that I was doing or callings that I had or activities I'd been to and things like that. And so it sort of made her feel a little more comfortable with it. She was getting to know the community. She had met a few of my friends and was feeling a little more comfortable. And she actually told me a story one time of a pool party with a bunch of their friends where someone said something about, oh, those crazy Mormons, they worship Joseph Smith. And I guess I had talked to Diana about who Joseph Smith was, and she pipes up right away and just says, oh, actually, they don't. I know this. Like, it was a Trivial Pursuit question that she had the answer to, kind of a thing. Like, had a little educational moment with these people who probably didn't really care, you know, but she knew something. She was excited about knowing something about this group of people. She also played the harp, and there are a few hymns that she ended up really liking, and so I would be visiting for I lived in Kalamazoo up until 6 years ago when I moved to Utah to go to BYU. When my husband was there, I transferred out here. But I would come by the house on weekends and all kinds of things. And sometimes I would come downstairs to Come Ye Saints or Come Thou Fount being played. Aww. And I thought it was like the radio or something. And then I would turn the corner and there she was with the little green book open, you know, and just playing her little heart out. She passed away almost 3.5 years ago, and requested to hear those songs before she passed away. So those two in particular sort of stayed with her.
Wonderful.
So she got more and more comfortable. River realized that it probably wasn't a phase, you know, so she got more and more anxious in a lot of ways. And it was lucky that they had each other, I guess, to sort of balance each other out a little bit. But so then, let's see. When I one of the other sort of favorite sort of crossover moments was when Diana got her first cancer diagnosis, and she was sort of reaching out for all manner of curative experiences, and alternative medicines and things like that are pretty common in my house growing up. And she was interested in those things, and she approached me about a priesthood blessing and just said, is that a thing that people outside of the church can access, or what's the deal with that kind of opportunity? And I said, oh, of course, it's totally fine. And she had been to our little branch building and had even played a few special musical numbers on her harp before, so she knew where it was, and came after our church meetings. And my branch president, who in a lot of ways is like a father to me and has been a good family friend to both of my parents and my sisters, administered that blessing. And I probably don't remember that much of it except for the gentle spirit that was there. But Diana remembered several details about it. And when she received a second cancer diagnosis in 2012 and was eventually in hospice, she sat with me and talked to me a little bit about that priesthood blessing. And she said, you'll have to thank him for that blessing. I have thought about it a lot of times and have seen a lot of things that were mentioned come to pass in my life in various ways. And I've been thinking about getting another one. And I sort of perked up and thought, yes, this is like the perfect time. People do this. This is a normal, this would be a normal perfect time for you to get another priesthood blessing. And I would be happy to set that up, and started sort of breaking out the calendar. And before I got a chance to voice any of that, she just said, you know, but I'm still using the one that I have. And I couldn't really explain to you how she got that a way that maybe I had never got before. I never understood the use of priesthood blessings that way until that moment. And she used it right up until she walked away from all of us, you know?
Yeah.
So that was,
thanks for
that
sharing
was a sweet
that.
Moment
That's...
for me.
That's a very sacred moment, so thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
So up until this point, we've been talking about your point of view as a child in regards to the new policy. Of course, there's a second part of the policy, which, you know, you do not have personal experience with because your parents weren't members of the church. But would you share from your knowledge of the community what you think?
I'm not sure that seeing it written down in paper is all that surprising to everybody. It is it's a belief, a teaching of the church that has been around for a while. But I think that the emotions that we're seeing right now really come from that idea of people thinking the conversation was changing a little bit, and the surprise is really one of the biggest pieces. I hesitate to get on like a big soapbox about something like that, but I would say that for myself, I've found going through the actual documents, and if there were questions about how it would affect me, or if there are people who end up listening to this who think, how is it going to affect me? And it's vague and ambiguous on some parts as well, that it is always valuable to have those conversations openly. So I've already met with my bishop and sort of gone through this document saying, let's talk about some of these things. And it was, again, it was a positive conversation for me. But because I have found some sense of personal peace with a lot of the parts, and there are several parts of this new policy, I don't think gives me the right to try and use that piece to devalue someone else's sorrow, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
There's any number of life experiences that inform the way people come to where they are. And one of my favorite parts about the baptismal covenants we have all made if we're members of the church, is to mourn with those that mourn. And so regardless of the sort of personal peace or any amount of personal revelation that brings understanding to new pieces, or even if people are just willing to say, let's wait a minute and see how the church might have really wanted to deal with something like this and how it rolls out a little bit, even none of that gives anyone the right to explain away the pain of someone else. And it speaks more to our Christ-like attributes to be willing to say, I'm sorry, and to say, I'm sorry that you're hurting, too. That's maybe the most important conversation to be having. And it's less important to try to debate with each other about what's really right or what's really wrong or what should be different.
Beautifully said. Thank you. Elder Christofferson's brother, Tom Christofferson, said in an interview that he did a couple of days ago that he was disappointed about the sort of the grouping of the gay community as this sort of faceless mass, rather than treating individual situations like yours on a case-by-case basis. What is your reaction to that idea that this policy kind of groups all people that have had your similar experiences into something under one policy rather than taking them by a case-by-case basis? You spoke a little bit before about how you see a need to sort of establish a criteria or a standard for how cases like yours are handled. But what about that idea of, you know, sort of making the gay community like an other, a group that
yeah.
all have to fall under this rather than taking it individually?
So I think that, like we were talking about earlier, with any kind of church policy, there are maybe very good things that happen, and there may be negative experiences or negative unforeseen or possibly even seen sort of side effects of something. I really identify with that idea of grouping having a side effect of being the other, and how we get into like an us-they situation. And what I would hope to have happen is that idea of mourning with those that mourn and all of the other Christ-like attributes that we study on a regular basis in Preach My Gospel or in Sunday school and things like that, that those things take precedent over any type of other group. And that's a hard thing to do, and it's a hard thing to ask a large society to do. And so we'll all just be flexible with each other, I hope, as we work on something like that. But, you know, I lost my train of thought just a little bit. You were mentioning...
Well, I love that you're using River and Diana's emphasis on flexibility to bring that to and help all of us be better.
You know, that came about, I'm not sure if this is something you need to include necessarily, but it was like my first Christmas away from home as a married person, and we were doing like melding of the family traditions sort of thing. And we did Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and Festival of Lights and Chinese New Year and all these things. And we didn't, winter solstice was our big winter holiday, and it was not Christmas. But we did so many things and varied throughout the years what we were doing, that I called Diana in like this frantic panic, like, I don't have any traditions. What am I doing? You know? And she was
I can
so
celebrate
gentle.
Kwanzaa, but I don't have anything to offer for Christmas.
Yeah, like, what am I doing? And we had extended family. I mean, we did do Christmases with both sides of my grandparents and aunts and uncles and things like that, but they didn't belong to me, you know? And
yeah.
Diana was very tender and kind listening to me, and then she just said, Diana, Laura, your holiday tradition is flexibility, and thank goodness for that, you know? And I thought, oh, you're sort of right. So, I mean, that works because you do different things for different holidays, but it also works in terms of, like, when you burn something you're planning to serve for a potluck at, you know, a church function or something, you're okay with going to get a pizza and not looking like the best homemaker ever, you know, because my family tradition is flexibility, so... I'm going to be flexible, darn it, you know?
I love it. Well, an alert. Oh,
yeah,
go,
no,
go ahead. I just want to really conclude with, if you're willing to share, what, how did you learn about the new policy, and what was your initial reaction?
So I have a friend on Facebook who I maybe haven't talked to in several years, who sent me a message just of the PDF she had seen on John Dalen's Facebook page, and then saw a Salt Lake Tribune article about it, and sent both of those my direction, and just said, I automatically thought of you and wondered what you thought, you know. And I'm not even going to tell you how many fake Facebook messages I had in the next 24 hours that were basically that same sort of sentiment. Not that the amount of messages and people wondering what I thought was a burden. It was really, I think the people who got in touch to say, how are you, is exactly that sign of sort of Christ-like attribute sort of thing I was talking about. You know, the idea of not saying, tell me what your perspective is on this because yours is the only one that's important, or, you know, I'm going to gauge how I feel about it based on what you're going to feel about it. Just, how are you? This is something that's new language for all of us. And I wasn't sure if it was for real, honestly. And it took my breath away, for sure. If I'm being honest, I'll also say that I knew it would make the holiday season going home to visit home a little more complicated, a little more tender, a little more gentle. And I had to sit down a little bit. I had to take a minute and take a breath. And you know, what I didn't do, though, is hop on social media anywhere and say what I thought about it. Because I, again, with flexibility, I guess, I think not making assumptions and wanting to be well-informed and having an educated something to say is important, and is important to a lot of my friends. And I was surprised to see so many people being so well-informed so quickly, even if it had only been a half an hour after it was, I guess the right word is leaked. People had already really formed ironclad opinions about it, and that was surprising to me. I purposely took a lot of time to process. The emotions are still, I mean, they were fresh. It was hard to hear, and it was confusing a little bit, and honestly, taking time with the ecclesiastical leaders that I have has been really valuable, to go carefully through each thing and be able to ask questions of all kinds has been really great. Probably the greatest emotion that I have, which may be different from other people's, is just the loss that we all have experienced, is the loss of the opportunity to see how the priesthood leaders, the apostles and the first presidency, and how they might have so tenderly gone about talking to their people about this, people that they love, about these things. And that's a loss that we all share, I think. I thought a lot about Elder Bednar's talk, which the name of it I don't remember, but the line that he said over and over again was, from the man that I love, a man that I love. Mm-hmm. And I thought, these are men that I do love, and I do think that they love all of us, and that means it'll take a little time to understand and be able to see some of that love. And for some people, maybe they won't ever see it, and that's also a loss that we all share, because those people are precious.
Thank you. This
Sure.
has been a gift to me to hear your perspective from the inside, from a very different place than I am coming at it from. And I know it's a gift to our listeners and readers. So I deeply appreciate you sharing all of these sacred thoughts with us. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.